Thank you so much, Christine and Chris. And it might make sense for you both to come up to the front since you'll be primarily engaged in this discussion. So we have about 25 minutes or so for Q&A, and we welcome questions, comments, reactions to what you saw. Please feel free to direct a question to one or both of the speakers. And traditionally, we like to start with a question from our online audience. Do you all have one ready to go, or should we throw it to in person first? And also feel free to let us, oh, okay. All right, so we'll start with an in-person question and then come back to here. Oh, and please state your name and organization, if you will.
Yeah, hi. My name is Dr. Tom Herlihy. I'm with Land O'Lakes. Chris, I had a question for you. I really liked your presentation and talking about the demand for wood and timber and pulp and the fact that in Africa, the largest contribution to deforestation is for charcoal and fuel. I was recently in the Dominican Republic, and anybody who's ever gone there and flown over the island of Hispaniola can't help but be struck by the green line between the deforestation in the west on Haiti and the fact that in the east we still have a lot of forests, especially cocoa. And when I was last there about a month ago, I was told the main reason for this is because the government made a decision about a decade ago to subsidize the cost of kerosene for home cooking. Therefore, through a government subsidy, they've discouraged deforestation. I was wondering if you were aware of that, if you could talk about that as a potential policy or strategy for countries in Africa to follow. Thank you very much.
I think I can use this mic. Everyone can hear. I'm not actually familiar with the Dominican Republic case, but throughout Africa, I mean, charcoal is a huge, years ago it was $8 billion a year business. I'm not sure what it is now. But the fact is that people don't have a lot of alternatives, even in cities. And I personally have tried to urge my energy colleagues whenever I can in different parts of the NCE network to look at this because that will make a huge difference. We have to, you know, part of systems thinking is we have to start with asking why do people do what they do? And then what can we, how can we help in a way that they can do what they need to do without unintended consequences? And the charcoal one in Africa is huge and often neglected.
We'll pass it to our online audience and then come back here.
Great. So we have 80 participants joining us online currently, a very active community. And John Russell from Eco Food Systems Consulting in Oregon asks, what parameters were used to assess the human well-being component of the Landscapes for People report? The question's for you, Christine.
Not 100% sure I understand the question. Do you think he's referring to the second report I talked about?
Yes, I think so.
Okay.
We can ask for clarification, but.
Yeah, that would be helpful. I'm not 100% sure. I appreciate that.
We'll bring it back to in person. Let's see, I'll come all the way to the back.
Hi, I'm Tanya Rawl with CARE USA. Thank you both for your presentations. I particularly want to thank you for bringing up the importance of really engaging farmers in research so that we make sure that the information and the practices that we're exploring are those that are going to meet their needs. And I want to ask a question really to follow up on that, on how you see governments being able to engage farmers in landscape-level planning, and what do you see as the barriers to doing that, given the primacy of food insecurity and the need to tackle poverty in places like Ethiopia, but then also the challenge, really, of doing so in the context of different kinds of land tenure policy?
Okay.
So I think there's a lot of different ideas that, just as you were asking your question, that come to mind. I think certainly one of the ideas that people talk about is inside the context of development programs, which do actually touch farmers, if you build a research component into those programs, and I think there's probably a lot of different ways to do that, and it probably depends very much on the structure of the program. And incidentally, there can actually end up being some really useful kind of M&E side benefits of that. But I think really rethinking the information dimension, and I think obviously we're in very much in that transition, but I think this idea of it really increasingly thinking about development programs that are very much about kind of a multi-directional learning process, where it's oriented around addressing core drivers and addressing core, really setting targets, but being much more fluid about how you get there, creating space and a set of different pilot programs, and leaving room in these development programs for pilot initiatives that really are that kind of active learning dimension. I think another really important piece too, and I think again, there's probably a lot of good examples of this around the world, is making sure that the sets of national and international research institutions that are present in any given place are engaged. And I think that's often difficult to do because of the siloing. There's a lot of, a program is rolling out, there's a lot of targets and deadlines, and there's often not a lot of room, both in terms of time and budget, to really take in and find a lot of portals to bring in the existing institutions. And that can take the form of whether we're talking about CGIAR centers, or we're talking about national research, or we're talking about places like, and again, in the forest side, the International Model Forest Network. So here's an international network that has a research to action orientation. Finding networks, these international and regional networks, and bringing them into some of the design processes, maybe taking advantage of some of their kind of research to action capabilities, and building those into programs. And I think at the end of the day, it's really about having a more fluid capacity to deliver on program, but really keeping the targets in mind, would be one basic strategy that I would think of.
I agree, of course, and I'd like to just add that, as we mentioned, there are different ways to go about promoting productive landscape approaches, but the project mode is an important one, and it's limited by the fact that it's so labor-intensive and capital-intensive, it's hard to be extensive on it, yet we can still do a lot. And one of the lessons, I think, that comes out of the project mode is that you really have to have themes in there that farmers can focus on if they're going to agree to collaborate. If you're dealing with, I can think of places in Costa Rica where one farm includes all the key elements of the landscape, the upslope, the downslope, the forest, the pasture, the riparian areas, and so forth. There it's just a matter of sustainable farming. And even in a place like Niger, where you saw there are small farms, there aren't a lot of externalities across farms. I mean, people are facing, there aren't a lot of slopes to begin with. The way the water is distributed and whatever, everyone has pretty much the same problem. So you're not really redistributing from one group to another. But the problem is so many of the places that we work in the world have lots of small farms, and we have upslope and downslope, and we have water sources and so forth. These create externalities. They create market failures, if you like. What the guy up the slope does affects the person down the slope. And that's where you need land use planning, you need governance. And to get that, I think the project mode shows that it's not just a question of having a strong central government or any of those things. It's basically you have to have thought out themes that allow people to see their advantage. I mean, it doesn't hurt to have some strong governance somewhere, but you've got to really have themes that they can relate to. Livestock is a powerful one because everyone does it in smallholder systems pretty much, but they need to do it differently. And that is one of the entry points. There are other entry points. And soil management is critical. I think any farmer can understand the advantage of managing their soils. The question is their actions alone going to be enough? And what exactly are they getting out of it?
A question from online.
Yes, so we have a clarification on the last question. John says, yes, the priorities for research in African landscapes report in the slide called multifunctionality, you mentioned systematic assessment of yield, income, human well-being, and ecosystem services outcomes. What parameters were used to assess human well-being?
Okay, so that's a really useful clarification. So what that slide is talking about is it's pointing in the direction of areas we need to go. So there's not, I wasn't talking about a particular study so much as pointing to the fact that in the research literature, there are lots of different ways that all those types of those major kind of categories of interest or benefits are parameterized, and they can be tremendously different. And so I think perhaps at the heart of the question is that maybe there are some good ideas about the best ways to consistently monitor human well-being, maybe for certain regions, probably not globally. So I wouldn't venture in this context to offer sort of any specific idea, but I think the central theme from the conversation in Nairobi was that we have to figure out what are those ways and how can we do it more consistently across different areas so that we end up with a bigger picture and a more systematic assessment of human well-being across different contexts. So sorry if that's not the kind of giving you the answer that would be useful, but I think the idea is that we don't have that answer yet. Maybe people who I'm not a specialist in the kind of human dimension side, so maybe there are others who can do a better job with that.
Thanks. I'm Scott Bodie, and I work at ACD Ivoca. I heard you guys mention governance a couple of times. I used to work at USAID. I was part of the team that helped to develop the Nature, Wealth, and Power framework, and I thought what was useful about NWP was it brought out governance, more than nature or wealth. And I think a landscape approach, and you don't have to convert me, I've been converted for a long time, implies governance, good governance. And I'll point to an area of interest and concern that I have for, and it's the West Africa cocoa sector. And I see that industry seems to be investing more, I don't have numbers on this, in open cocoa rather than shaded cocoa. And since the forests of West Africa are very fragmented and the governance of those spaces are quite contested, my concern is the goal of increasing the productivity, which is a good goal, of cocoa from 300 kg per hectare to 1,000 kg per hectare will not lead to less pressure on those fragmented landscapes. It's going to lead to more pressure unless we have equal investments into the shaded cocoa systems that are, produce 70% of the cocoa from West Africa. So that isn't really a question, but I did want to hear a little more elaboration on the importance of governance as it relates to landscape approaches. Thanks.
I can take a first crack and then hand it over to you. I think the thought I had as you were asking your question is really these four categories that I talked about, in my mind, are kind of part of that story of governance, because governance has a lot of different aspects and different maybe sequences for any particular region or sets of challenges. And I think part of governance is some sort of shared information base. And I think without a shared information base that describes, in this case, we're talking about the cocoa sector, we're talking about fragmentation, we're talking about probably displacement, we're talking about a whole set of issues, that that some issues are of great concern in the cocoa sector, and some issues are of great concern to people living in different regions, and some issues are of great concern to government and to the NGO sector. And so when you have a lot of different players from the civil society, private sector, public sector, kind of all with their own dog in the fight, it becomes quite easy to be very focused on kind of singular linear response strategies. But one of the values of some of these context-specific assessments, where you really look at the sets of issues and try to say, look, here are the major drivers, here's kind of the major trajectories of where we're headed. That doesn't really look that great. Where can we start to realign and have a different set of scenarios that we're aiming towards? And again, this idea of these coordination frameworks, and I think government really does have a key, often a very key role here. to sort of set the frame, to set the stage, to say this is where we're headed. We may not get there exactly, you know, kind of where we're charting, but, you know, we're trying to point the right direction, and we're articulating the things we're going to do as government, but we're also really trying to articulate the absolutely essential roles that, you know, private business needs to play, that multiple levels of government need to play, the civic sector, the reliance on international partners. And I think that those start to look like something that's better governance when you have these sort of heavy information base that leads into some sort of reasonably well-founded strategies and starts to create the mechanism for different players, sometimes working closely together in real kind of public-private civic partnerships, but sometimes operating independently, but again, theoretically moving in the same direction instead of at cross purposes, and ideally with a greater awareness of what some of the implications of certain strategies are.
There was kind of a private sector aspect to the question, and I'm not from the private sector, but I have worked a fair amount with private sector people, and my impression is that the primary concern, at least of the formal international private sector, and Tom, correct me if I'm wrong, but is really to reduce risks, because the profit margins tend to be quite high, but the risks are quite high. So if you can do something about the risk, you kind of handled the bottom line a bit. And two risks are particularly relevant here. There's the social instability risk, which is always there anywhere where you are. And you're dealing with rapidly changing situations with lots of very poor people. And the other big risk is the sort of ecosystem services risk. And there, I don't know the cocoa sector very well, but there are many investments, whether it's in cut flowers in Kenya, as in some of your colleagues have shown, Christina, I think you've been involved in that, or whether it's Nestle bottling water in the Philippines, or many cases where really it's not it's very much in the interest of these investors to do something to help people that are their neighbors, prevent them from polluting water, which often means not cutting trees or not pasturing cattle right next to the river or whatever it is. And so there are definitely the conditions there for working with a broad variety of actors. Now, again, I don't know this specific example in West Africa, but the conversation is more likely to go well and be productive if it's looked at in a larger scale, where you look at what all the different actors need and how you can arrange things and collaborate so everybody's better off. Because ultimately, that's what the landscape business is about. It's that we're not talking about a zero-sum game. We're talking about net benefits.
And just to build on that, because I think that's such an important point, this idea of different perceptions of risk and getting that to a more shared understanding of risk. And certainly in the cocoa sector, I think that's very much growing, as there's an awareness that, hey, what's our long-term supply going to look like? And I'll point to a piece of work that was done by some LPFN colleagues on reducing risk. And there is a case study focused on cocoa that really does look at that, and where there's real recognition in the cocoa sector, like, we have to do something that's quite different from just even a supply chain sustainability approach to one that's a landscape approach that looks at the sets of larger risks that are affecting people in the communities and the regions where we want to have a sustainable sourcing strategy, where we really have kind of critical operations. So I think that conversation is really evolving in the private sector side, but I think that capacity across different sectors to plug and play with each other, to speak the same language, I think really gets to your governance question. You know, yes, we can know that we need to have multi-stakeholder cooperation, but to get to a place where we have the capacity as individuals working in different companies and agencies and NGOs and so on, to get to a place where we know how to do it, that's a bit of a cultural transition we're in the middle of right now, I think.
Question from our online audience.
So we have two questions from, apologies if I mispronounce your name, Yehenu Zudi, joining from the Netherlands, Technical Center for Agricultural and Rural Cooperation. So the first question is for Chris, which is, what was the underlying reason for the pitiful record of agriculture's inability to access adaptation funds? Do you see some imbalance in the geographic distribution of beneficiaries of the adaptation fund? And the question for Christine is, what incentives need to be put in place to ensure a landscape approach to land management?
Uh,
I think the honest, well, actually, I was going to say the honest answer is I don't know, but that's not quite true. So I'll give you an even more honest answer. I think the fundamental reason, disbursements, when I gave the $53 million a year average figure, that's disbursements from projects. Projects are primarily designed to ensure good governance over public funds. They also require all kinds of safeguards, and all both financial and fiduciary type safeguards, and other kinds, social and environmental and so forth. And they're inherently a slow means of response to a problem. But over time, I think those disbursements will go up, but it's a slow process. And it really, I think, is a legitimate question to ask whether they can go up fast enough under business as usual. And my own feeling on that is probably not. So we need to think about the forms of assistance that are both not just the supply of money, but I guess my point is the format through which assistance is purveyed. We really, you know, I don't want to say we have a crisis because it's going to be an enduring crisis. It is a crisis. We have a serious issue that needs attending to quickly. We need a response, and I think we need a different format than the traditional format of assistance projects to agricultural projects. I'm not sure I know the answers for that, but I might add there are parallels. When we had a food crisis, we found ways to speed up the project response that worked quite well. There one reason it worked well was because it was an emergency and you could get everyone to agree to sort of trust each other temporarily, even though people don't trust each other in the project business. But this is a conversation we really need to have in the context of the how, not the what to do, but how to do it. And it's going to be an important inter-donor conversation in the first instance. How do you do multilateral responses? You know, what kinds of trust do you place in whoever's managing that trust fund? What kinds of expectations do you have? You know, who is actually capable of running such a mechanism, so forth.
So the question about incentives for integrated landscape management, I mean, part of the answer is the incentives are everywhere, and I think awareness is growing of that, that really to deal with some of the challenges that we've been talking about today, they're really, I think Chris articulated this, there really is increasing recognition that that is the approach. I think there are some, it's almost in a way about removing barriers to that approach, and I'll just mention a couple of examples that come to mind. We saw that a change in kind of tenure and the sort of legal structure had such a big impact in the changes in the Sahelian region in terms of regreening. And so sometimes it's tweaking some of these tenure laws, and so that's kind of a removal of a barrier to individuals in a very highly distributed way, changing what they do and operating in a different way. I would say there's some good examples, and I think the CRGE in Ethiopia is an example of something also quite important, this kind of more whole of government, cross-ministry, de-siloing across government is another really important general strategy that I think makes sense. And again, that's going to require very senior leadership in national governments. But I think the idea here is if you're going to think about integrated landscape management, you've got ministries of forestry and of ag and, you know, and environment and water and so on. If they're siloed, if their mandates are siloed, if they're operating in a siloed way and there are no mandates to them that really expect them to work more closely together, that's a barrier. There's maybe something similar that operates in some of the major agricultural businesses. That orientation that doesn't really leave room in their internal processes to think on a longer time frame, to think across different units of the enterprise. So I think this idea of de-siloing is a really important one if we're thinking about kind of creating better space for integrated landscape management to take place in all the idiosyncratic ways that we need it to across the world.
We have time for one or maybe two more questions. I'll get you. But in case you need to take off quickly, I just wanted to mention the surveys that are on your chairs. Those are always very helpful for us for planning future events. So if you wouldn't mind just filling that out and either leaving it on your chair or dropping it at the front, we'll find all the filled out ones. And also before you take off, please take more coffee, pastries, and fruit so that we don't have any of the food waste that you mentioned. So we'll see if we can squeeze in one or two more.
Thanks so much. I really appreciate the conversation discussions by both of you. My name is Anita Campion. I'm the president of Connexus Corporation. We organize the annual Cracking the Net conference, and this upcoming year is focused on developing rural and agricultural markets amid climate change. So very relevant topic, and USAID is a big supporter. My question is, you know, when I agree with the de-siloing concept, and that's part of what we try to do with the conferences, to change the lens each year to look at a little bit different angle, this year being the climate change angle. I'm curious, especially case from Ethiopia, you know, with 80% of the funding coming from the government, you know, what caused that or what was the driver behind that? I mean, I know there would have been drought and famine. Was that enough to, you know, was it the crisis that pushed things politically, or can you talk about that a little bit more, and if there's any kind of lessons learned for to get other countries to move, you know, or donors to move to support more climate change adaptation?
Buck, and just to point you towards the report, and I can certainly provide you the link, because I, you know, haven't given it a thorough read. I just happened to look at it the other day and saw those two charts, and I thought it was worth including. So I'm actually curious to dive in a little bit more myself to understand that. And actually, it'd be quite interesting to look across a suite of countries to ask exactly the questions that you're asking. But I think one of the, I guess, ideas that I would have would be, you know, having made some of these investments in looking strategically across the economy at mitigation potential, looking across a wide set of potential sustainable land management practices, having kind of done that assessment work, does that actually create buy-in and the potential across different units of government and across other important constituencies to liberate spending? I have no idea if that's true, but I think we should ask that question. And that report may offer some insights, as well as I'm sure other good work that's out there.
I think I actually know the answer to that, and it's only because of age, but it was USAID that did it, because about 40 years ago, USAID had an intelligent program that sent American teachers into African universities, and they sent a guy called John Meller to teach at Alamaya. And John Meller is a great proponent of agricultural-led growth. And when the current government, Prime Minister Melis came to power, he was a great believer in agricultural-led growth for whatever reason. And you can also find political economy explanations of where that particular government drew its support and so forth. But the fact is, government of Ethiopia is one of the governments around the world that is really committed to agricultural-led growth. They've bought into this, and they've acted. I mean, they have made their own budget allocations that reflect this. So that's the fundamental reason.
And just to build on that, you know, this idea of these kind of cultural histories and path dependency is really quite important. We're doing a piece of work in some East Asian agricultural commodity landscapes, and we are seeing that pattern as well in those studies, which is that if a country's had certain kinds of experiences and used certain kinds of mechanisms, they're comfortable with them, whether they've worked or not, you know. But I think that idea that the comfort level and familiarity and how that sort of perpetuates through different units of government and other parts of the sort of social economy, make a difference. And how you kind of try to come in with something that looks really unfamiliar and brand new, that's actually, you know, part of adapting program goals to specific places, is understanding what the political culture allows.
All right, we'll take one last very quick question from our online audience, and then I hope that all of you will stick around for a bit of networking and we can follow up with the presenters afterwards as well with any additional questions that come through.
Jerry Brown from Agriculture Results, Inc. in D.C. asks, or states at first, agroecological research networks make sense, and there really is a gap in the relationship between agriculture, environment, and livelihoods. In establishing such a network, how would the network participants take a more regional approach to research and findings, therefore leapfrogging over current research networks and lack of research results sharing?
Just one kind of quick example from the discussions in Nairobi this summer that we talked about is the idea of focusing on some very tangible potential areas of collaboration. So one of the ideas there is that, say it's the idea of creating a new network or kind of jumpstarting an existing network. Start by looking at the resources that individual countries, what their individual research institutions have available, and that's everything from, sort of traditions of research, equipment that they own, field staff for research, look at what they have, and then look across and see where there's synergy. So if there's particular expertise that one country, a real strength that they have because of either infrastructure investments they've made in research or special capacities, how can they be of value to partners in another country and vice versa? So you actually start to articulate a little bit of this kind of, who can scratch each other's back, and be very pragmatic would be one idea that I would offer into the mix, so that you build a network not kind of on concepts, but on very practical exchanges of capacity and information, so that you actually start to see and build this sort of like we're stronger together kind of approach. So I would say that's probably not the only component of a successful network, but I think that's a very tangible one that people could recognize as useful.
Great. All right. Well, I don't like to run over too long on our seminar, so I'd like to thank our speakers. One last round of applause for them. Thank you very much for coming.